You're listening to Radio Albion, talk radio for the nationalist community.
Welcome to the Daily Nationalist. Today's date is Tuesday, the 7th of July, 2020, and you're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, broadcasting at RadioAlbion.com. Well, I want to begin today just by elaborating on what I was saying yesterday about the origin of the Scots and the word Scotland. And I'm going to quote from a book here called The Scottish Declaration of Independence, an analysis by E. Raymond Capt, M-A-A-I-A-F-S-A-S, Scott. And he says, "The History of Ireland, by Moore, states that the ancient Irish, called the Danai, or Danes, separated from Israel around the time of the Exodus from Egypt, crossed to Greece, and then invaded Ireland. Historians call these people the Tuatha De Danann, or the tribe of Dan. The Leabhar Gavala, or Book of Conquests of Ireland, give their earlier name as Tuatha De, meaning people of God. On Ptolemy's ancient map of Ireland, we find, in the northeastern corner of the island, such names as Dan Soar, Dan's resting place, and Dan Soberzi, Dan's habitation. Gladstone's Juventus Mundi and the Old Psalter of Cashel both state that some of the Grecian Danai left Greece and invaded Ireland. Petanius, the 6th century BC, speaks of the Danai as being a Hebrew people originally from Egypt who colonised Ireland." And that was written in the 6th century BC, remember. This isn't new information. This is information records that we have had for millennia. The Milesians, who invaded Ireland circa 1000 BC and subjugated the Tuatha De Danann, the people of God, were also a branch of the Hebrew stem. It was from a later group of Milesians about the 5th century BC that Ireland received one of its earliest names, Scota. The Milesians, in general, were commonly called Scoti or Scots by the early Latin historians and poets. It was said that the name Scots came from Scota, a daughter of a far eastern king, Zedekiah, who married Gaedhalus, a Milesian prince. It was from this union that the kings of Tara, or Ireland, were descended. The marriage is said to have occurred during the reign of a pharaoh who was drowned in the Red Sea. This would have been the pharaoh Hofra, the 21st dynasty, who provided refuge for the prophet Jeremiah and the daughters of King Zedekiah of Judah. The pharaoh was later murdered in his boat in 566 BC. The Chronicles of Scotland record the story of their ancestor Gaedhalus leaving Egypt with his wife Scota and friends this way. Rather than to "abide ye manifest vengeance of gods," a reference to God's judgment on the remnant that had fled to Egypt to escape Nebuchadnezzar, and travelling by the Mediterranean Sea, "after lang time he landed in ain part of Spain, call it Lusitan, later called Partengal. After this he built the city of Brigance in Spain and call it his subdities or subjects Scotis in honour and affection of his wife." Many historians today erroneously refer to the Milesians as Celts and Gaels. Actually, they were only the forerunners of the Celtic tribes that wound their way across Europe from the east turbulently meeting and finally blending in amity and flowing onwards in one great Gaelic stream into the island of Britain. The Celts were kinsmen, but mainly of the later westward migrations of the Israelites as they left the regions of Gojan, the Assyrian captivity, by way of the upper Euphrates Gorge, which we read about in 2 Esdras 1343. Most of them crossed the Black Sea to the Carpathian Mountains called Arsareth in the Apocrypha. From there, they migrated up the Danube into Central Europe and became known as Celts and Gauls. And there's a note here, archaeological evidence in the form of clay cuneiform tablets of the royal correspondence of the Assyrian Empire have established the fact that the Celts are the Cimmerians, or the Israelites, who were called during their captivity by the Assyrians Gimera or Gemera. Between 400 to 100 BC, the Celts poured into Britain to form the bedrock of the British race. One group in Spain, known as Iberes, the Gaelic name for Hebrews, moved into Ireland, naming the island Hibernia, a name that still exists. From them came the High Kings of Tara that ruled Ireland for several centuries. About 500 AD, the Scottish king Fergus More McIrk, the Great, of the Gaelic kingdom of Dalriada in Ireland, left his Irish palace at Dunseverick and invaded the southwestern part of the Pictish kingdom in northern Britain. The Picts, or in Gaelic Cruitni, meaning pictured men because they painted themselves, were a confederation of Celtic tribes. They spoke a slightly different language than Celtic and had different customs from the Gaels of the west and the Britons of Strathclyde in the south. The Scots from Ireland were successful in driving the Picts north out of Argyllshire. They set up their new capital inside the ramparts of an old Pictish fort on the hill of Dunat. From there, Fergus ruled both halves of his kingdom, one in Ireland and the other in Scotland. For a time, the Scottish kingdom of Dalriada appears to have been dependent upon Irish Dalriada, but around 575 AD, Aidan, the son of King Gabran, secured its independence and was crowned King of Scotland upon the Stone Liefail, the Stone of Destiny, which I've talked about before in the podcasts that we did on Edward Longshanks, because he took the stone from Scotland and took it to England, where it is now part of the coronation chair that all the monarchs of England have been crowned upon ever since. One of Aidan's successors, Kenneth, became king of the Picts about 843 AD, and gradually the name Dalriada, both in Ireland and in Scotland, fell into disuse, and that's when we get the name of Scotland. So we can see from that anyway that there aren't any Indians in there, there aren't any Africans in there. The Scots are quite clearly white. I mean, it tells us here that they can be traced back to the Israelites, the Israelite tribes. And throughout the Bible, we read descriptions of the Israelite tribes, of them being white. We trace them back to the sons of Noah. And the sons of Noah, of course, the ark that Noah supposedly saved himself from the deluge in, that landed in the Caucasus. And his sons then came down from the Caucasus, and his sons colonized Europe and the Fertile Crescent. We can look at the names of all his sons. I think there's 664 of them, 60-odd. And it tells us that they became nations. And we can look at those nations and we can see that they were all white. There is Tiras in there. The Thracians are in there. The Mizraim, who were the Egyptians. The Pelasgians, Peleg. All these nations were white, basically. And then we read in the Old Testament that the people that were of mixed race were called Arabs. And it was very important that people retained their heritage, just the same as it was in Britain. I mean, if you wanted to be a Druid, you had to show that your pedigree was pure going back 10 generations. And that was exactly the same with the Levites, the priestly cast of the Israelites. They had to show that their pedigree was pure, going back 10 generations. And this is why it's so important in the Bible that they have these genealogies, and they show the family trees. And when they're showing these family trees, it's because they are showing that these people are white. They are not mixed in with the indigenous peoples of the lands that they colonized. And I'm going into this because I've got an article today that I want to highlight, which shows you just how corrupted the church has become and how it denies all of this. I mean, even if you don't look into it in depth, like I have just pointed out there, and check out the names of all these nations and their histories, the tradition of the church has always been that Japhet, one of the sons of Noah, was the father of the Europeans. Now, if Japhet was the father of the Europeans and all the European nations are descended from Japhet, that means that Ham and Shem, his two brothers, were also European. They were also white. There is no way they could have been anything else other than the same ethnicity as their brother. And yet the church today seems to be going back on all that teaching, which has been in place for thousands of years, and are now appearing to say that Jesus was actually black. That's what this article that I'm going to quote from today is saying. The Church of England is too white. Well, Jesus was a black man, according to the new Archbishop of York. How can he say this? I mean, besides everything that I've just gone through there, the Bible talks about the Israelites being fair-haired. It talks about them having blue eyes. It talks about them having ruddy cheeks, showing blood in the face, blushing. It talks about them blushing. In one instance, it talks about an instance of interbreeding, and some of them can no longer blush, and they are no longer Israelites. And the very fact that the Gospels begin with a family tree tracing Jesus's parentage on both sides, even from Joseph as well, even though Joseph was not his biological father, but it traces both of their family trees all the way back to show that they weren't mixed, to show that they were white, going all the way back to the sons of Noah. And yet this new Archbishop of York, who's obviously keen to show his anti-racist credentials, is just choosing to ignore all of that. And I guess he's just counting on the fact that most Christians today haven't bothered to actually research this and don't actually read their Bibles. Speaking to the Sunday Times, Stephen Cotterill praised the Black Lives Matter movement and said his inauguration this week as a white man replacing the outgoing Archbishop John Sentamu, who is black, is awkward for the church. So it's awkward to have a black man replaced by a white, but it's not awkward to have a white man replaced by a black in the Church of England. And it is the Church of England. It is supposed to represent the English people. And just like the government of the United Kingdom, which is supposed to represent the British people, it no longer represents the British people. It represents the interests of non-whites. And people will criticize Christianity and they will say, Christianity is calling for more refugees. Christianity is doing things like this. There's this bishop that is saying that it's awkward that he's white and it should be a black person that's put in there as the bishop. But what that really shows us is that the establishment church is just as much under the power of the enemies of the church as the government is under the power of the enemies of the British people. All our establishment, all our institutions have been taken over, basically, by people who do not have our best interests at heart and who put other people's interests above our own. It's not something that is the fault of Christianity. It's a universal problem with all our institutions. And people that would say, well, we should get rid of the church, that's as ridiculous as saying, well, we should get rid of the government because the government is malfunctioning at the moment. The church is malfunctioning. That is quite clear. And that just shows us, as I say, that this is a systemic problem that we have rather than anything within Christianity that is at fault. He continues, "The leadership of the Church of England is still too white, and I hope under my watch we will see further changes on that," asserting that the church has work to do, addressing the deep systemic issues of exclusion and prejudice. So he is essentially saying exactly the same as Hamza Youssef in Scotland was saying that I was talking about yesterday, that we need to replace more white people. So how can this not be seen as racist against whites? If this was in Africa and they were saying we need to replace more African people in the African churches with white priests and that will address the systemic issues of exclusion and prejudice, people would just say, what? How is that addressing issues of exclusion and prejudice to be prejudiced against blacks and excluding them from the church over there? And that is exactly what is happening here. We're seeing white people are being excluded. White people are being looked over despite their qualifications for leadership in the Church of England. And how long will it be? How far does this go on? When is enough enough? When Britain looks like South Africa? I mean, it's not like we don't have examples of what happens when we reach a maximum number of black people that have been brought in to replace whites. And the situation we get is the situation that we get in South Africa. And the church should be about Christianity. He should be talking about how we need the very best priests. We need priests that are well-versed in church tradition and church teaching. And instead of that, he is showing us that he is not well-versed in church teaching or tradition, and that he puts modern-day political correctness above everything else. This is the thing that really gets me about all of these. When we get somebody that is black or non-white and they're put into a position of authority, instead of saying, well, this is great, but really what we want is people in positions of authority that are qualified to do the job. We want people with that are most qualified and most capable of doing this position, that they instantly start saying, well, we need more black people in the position. We need more non-whites in the position. As if just the fact that they are a different race is going to mean that they do the job better than anyone else. And in actual fact, it means that they're not going to do the job better than anyone else because they would have just been picked to fill out a diversity quota. Cottrell, who the Times describes as a liberal moderniser, I would say a cultural Marxist, told the newspaper he wanted to celebrate Black Lives Matter and was certain that Jesus Christ would have joined in with their protests, many of which have erupted into violence in cities across the West. Yes, because Jesus was an anarchist, wasn't he? And he wanted to get rid of law and order. And he wanted to see Judea invaded by foreigners, didn't he? The Old Testament is full of instructions for the Israelites to allow themselves to be invaded by foreigners. Of course it doesn't. It is full of instructions that they are not to take wives of other races. They are not to have anything to do with the other races. In fact, they are not supposed to make treaties with them. They are not supposed to seek their peace. They are supposed to keep themselves entirely separate from them. So this Cottrell is basically ignoring all Christian teaching, all biblical teaching, and instead, again, he is promoting this modern anti-Christian teaching that the church seems to now have fallen for. He says, Jesus was a black man, and he was born into a persecuted group in an occupied country. Well, where is his evidence for that? Where is any evidence that Jesus was black? Where's the evidence that there were any black people around in Judea at this time? We can see that there were some mixed race people in Egypt, but they certainly weren't a part of the aristocracy in Egypt. When we read in the New Testament about the Ethiopian, we hear of an Ethiopian celibate who is obviously very well read, and he can only be an Israelite that was living in Ethiopia there's no way that he was black. We can read at the time, we're about 50 years before that time, and I think it was Herodotus in his histories, and he actually talks about the country of Ethiopia, and he says that there are two different types of people there. There is one group of people that are very much like the Greeks, very civilized. They have all the same understandings of civilization as the rest of the Roman world. And then there's another group of people there with fuzzy hair and long nails and shrill voices, and they run around naked, and they are as far removed from human kindness and civilization as it is possible to be. And not the sort of people that you would want to have in your civilized country. So that's the description that we have of black people at the time. We have no description of Jesus being black. In fact, as I say, we have his family tree listed at the beginning of every gospel to show that he wasn't even an Arab, let alone black. During the interview, he praised the inclusion of women in leadership within the church, but confessed to being very frustrated, often at the pace of change. And again, the New Testament is very clear. A woman should not be allowed to teach. And that was very, very important to the church that they didn't have women priests, because that brings up connotations of pagan priestesses. That was something that the pagans did. They had priestesses who would sleep with the congregation. Basically, they would have these orgies and sex magic, and that is a connotation of having women priests. But the main reason they said the church would say, and I've read this in the Douay Rheims, in the notes that go with the Douay Rheims, the first translation from Latin that the Catholic Church had, it has all these explanations of these verses in there. And it says that the reason why you should never allow a woman to be a priest or to teach is because the example that we are given of a woman teaching is Eve. And she taught Adam to eat of the forbidden fruit, which brought death into the world. And that was the teaching of the church for centuries. And this new archbishop is frustrated that that is not changing fast enough for him. And he praises the total reversal of biblical teaching and church tradition here. Cottrell went on to affirm his support for LGBTQ plus Christians, stating that pastoral guidance maintaining church teaching that heterosexual marriage remains the proper context for sexual activity should have been worded more carefully. And again, this is the opposite of what the Bible says. The Bible says that it's a capital sin. Sodomy is a capital sin. The very name itself, Sodomy, is named after the city that was destroyed by God because the people in it were crying out to heaven to be destroyed. They wanted it to be saved from themselves because of the grievous sin and harm that they were doing to one another. Their souls cried out to heaven for somebody to stop them doing what they were doing. And now we have somebody claiming to represent the church that thinks that that is perfectly fine, and he wants to see more of it. He says, there are people with strongly held traditional views that I understand and respect, and I want them to be a part of the church. But at the same time, I'm thinking of LGBTQ plus Christians and their experience. I don't want them to be disenfranchised or excluded, so we're going to have to find a way of living together with disagreement. Well, you can't really, how can they say that they are Christian if they're going to be living in sin like that? You're supposed to ask for forgiveness of your sins and do your best to stop sinning when you become a Christian. Not say the whole of Christianity has to change and accept my sin and accept it as being normal. And it says in the New Testament that if people aren't going to obey the Christian laws, then they have to be excluded. They do have to be excluded. They have to be kicked out of the church for the devil to deal with, basically. And it also tells us in the New Testament that homosexuality is a punishment that is sent on people for not having a strong enough love for the truth. They will be given up to lust for one another's bodies. It's in one of Paul's epistles. The Bible is very clear that homosexuality is wrong and that it is a sin. And yet now we have the church praising it and supporting it. And they're even supporting transgenders now, even though it says in the Old Testament that he who is wounded in the stones cannot be a part of the congregation. And it also has laws and commandments against men wearing women's clothes. Yet the church today supports it. The Essex-born church leader's remarks on Jesus and the Black Lives Matter movement echo comments from the Church of England's most prominent cleric, Justin Welby, in recent months. So this is coming down right from the top of the church. And you can make a safe bet that the actual rank and file of the church don't support this. And this is why the churches are empty and people no longer go to the churches, because they're disgusted at what the Church of England is teaching. Earlier this year, the Archbishop of Canterbury decried the church as deeply institutionally racist, professing, "I am almost beyond words. Personally, I am sorry and ashamed. I'm ashamed of our history, and I'm ashamed of our failure." Well, the church started out as European, didn't it? It's a European tradition that they have, over the last 500 years, they have tried to export to other countries. And he should really be ashamed of interfering in these other countries and interfering in these other nations and trying to bring them a religion which was never intended for them in the first place. The New Testament talks about bringing the gospel to the nations. The nations. It's referring to a particular group of nations that the Bible talks about right away from beginning to end. It's not talking about every nation in the world. There's no gospel to the Congolese. There's no gospel to the Cantonese, the Taiwanese. The gospels and the epistles are all directed to specific peoples. They're directed to specifically white peoples. After far-left activist Sean King demanded last month that all statues showing Jesus as Caucasian be torn down on the basis they are a form of white supremacy, Welby called for a rethink on traditional portrayals of the Son of God. Well, as far back as we can look at portrayals of Jesus and his disciples, you will see that they are all white. And primary documents are the earliest documents. I mean, the earliest representations that we have of Jesus and his apostles will be from within the first 400 or 500 years, and they're going to be the most accurate ones, and they all show them as white. You can even go back to 100 years ago and they will still all be white. It's only in the last 100 years that people seem to have forgotten this. And first off, they started saying, oh, well, he must have looked like these Ashkenazi Jews or these Sephardic Jews. And even that didn't happen until 50 years ago. And now they've gone from that to saying, well, he must have looked like an Arab. And now they're saying, well, he must be black. I mean, part of this is because people look at the area today and they see that there are non-white people there and they say, oh, it must have been non-white 2,000 years ago. Well, Judea was multicultural, but it was predominantly white. It was part of the Roman Empire. And the ones that were Arab types were the Canaanite types. There was King Herod, that was the Pharisees, that was the enemies in the New Testament. And all the Israelites, all the white people became Christians, and the ones with this Arab blood, they came up with this religion called Judaism that was based around the rabbis. And they wrote that down in about 500 AD. It was in a response to Christianity. The ones that were white became Christian, and all their representations of themselves show them as white. And the ones that were non-white became Jews. And then later on, when we got more Arabs and they became darker, they came out with their religion of Islam. In the wake of the Black Lives Matter protests, the church leader, that's Justin Welby, who has previously declared God to be gender neutral, called for a review into church statues and monuments, stating that some will have to come down and some names will have to change. Is his loyalty to God, or is his loyalty to political correctness? How can he say that God is gender neutral? Their whole point is that God is male. God is the patriarch, the family and is based upon man obeying God, woman obeying man, and children obeying woman. And that is the hierarchy. And God is male. That's all there is to it. He always has been male. His character and attributes are male attributes. And to say that he has a female part is to introduce feminism and equality. And obviously, Justin Welby would be accused of a heretic if he was to say that there was a goddess. So he's sneakily going halfway there and saying, oh, God is gender neutral. So he's a hermaphrodite, is he? He's a transgender, seems to be what Justin Welby is saying here. And of course, the transgender or the hermaphrodite is seen as holy to Freemasons and Gnostics. I mean, all of this, it isn't new, what is going on today. It's gone on for thousands of years. We can read in Boadicea's speech about the degeneracy of the Romans. We can read about Nero's favorite eunuch at the time. This degeneracy, this homosexuality, transgenderism, race mixing, it has always gone on, but we managed to put a stop to it for probably about 1500 years when we had Christendom, when we actually followed Christian law. And that's what these clerics should be upholding, not trying to tear it all down and seeking praise from Marxists and anarchists and people who hate Christianity. I mean, I dare say real Christianity, biblical-based Christianity, Justin Welby and this new priest here, they would hate it. They wouldn't even recognize it. And I don't see how they can reconcile what the Bible teaches and what the church used to teach with what they are promoting today. But then how can the government reconcile what it promotes today with what was in the Magna Carta? Our institutions have become taken over by traitors, exactly as was foretold in the Bible would happen in the end times. Anyway, thank you very much for listening. I will be back tomorrow with more of the Daily Nationalist for you. God bless and hail victory.
You're listening to Radio Albion, talk radio for the nationalist community.